And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Connor is here.
Good afternoon, Phil.
He'll probably be talking about films a little later. We're going to talk to Scott Taylor, EspritDeCorps.ca. He is the editor, publisher of Esprit de Corps. He also writes for the ChronicleHerald.ca. Scott Taylor is quite well known, I think, in Canada and probably around the world as a former soldier who puts out one of the most respected military journals, commentary on military matters, particularly Canadian forces. And very pertinent today. He'll be our first guest. Halfway point, we'll be talking to Steve Gowans. The focus is on Syria and the murky new war, that potential war that is developing. And I want to say that Scott Taylor, who will be our first guest, was once a hostage. He was once taken hostage in September 2004 by the very people who, and by the way, he was threatened with beheading. So we now know that wasn't theater, that he did go through the experience. He visited Iraq more than 20 times in between the year 2000 and 2005. And he's been, his journal is quite proud of the fact that it is known for its plain talk. They used to say plain talk and bad manners, but now they've decided that it's basically plain talk, that they don't have bad manners. And Scott has a column published very recently, a couple of very important columns. I hope people will read them, and I'll remind you that the site you're going to want to go to is EspritDeCorps.ca and to the ChronicleHerald.ca, where the column is called On Target. I think we're joined by Scott Taylor. Are you there, sir?
I'm here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. You're the ideal man to talk to. You were once a hostage, prisoner of the very people that we are hearing so much about today. And you have written a very interesting couple of columns here recently, one of the most recent being titled Diving Headfirst into a Bubbling Cesspool, or Cesspit. And previous to that, you'd written Crisis in Iraq just is not that simple. And you were commenting on the how Canada seems to be following rather quickly along in the wake of Obama's, whatever his strategy is. Let's start with this business. Why isn't it that simple? I mean, it's certainly being told simply by Obama.
Well, we always love to dumb these equations down and make it into a good guy versus bad guy, and I think we all sort of understand that extremists, Muslim extremists that are cutting off heads must be the bad guys here, and therefore it's going to be very simple. I mean, they've got, well, they were linked to Al-Qaeda until apparently they've now gone solo, this ISIS group. But in the north of Iraq, you don't just have one group of people. I mean, even this idea that we're going to support the Kurdish Peshmerga, and I've written about this, I covered the north. I've got 21 trips into northern Iraq between 2000 and 2005. And as you mentioned, I spent time, I mean, even not knowing the area, I still ended up as a hostage with the predecessor of ISIS, which at the time was known as Ansar al-Islam. So it gave me a fairly good insight into just some of the background issues that are happening here. And the idea of taking out ISIS now and just eliminating them from the equation, it's like removing a symptom. I mean, it's not the root of the problem. And this is where it lies in just in even the basic constitution that was brought in, and the policies that are being made from the government in Baghdad, the Shiite majority, which have sought, rather than to reconcile with the Sunni minority that was in control under Saddam Hussein, they've seen fit to basically ostracize them from any kind of political power. That said, I mean, now that even the moderate Sunnis are looking at ISIS as some sort of salvation from the persecution they're facing from the Baghdad government. So unless the Baghdad government changes its policies, you're going to find all kinds of willing volunteers to join the ISIS or any movement that's going to protect them from that that regime. So then, of course, back to the north, you've got the Kurdish factions, you've got Turkmens, which almost never get mentioned, but there's some 2 million Turkmens in the north, the Christians that are now dwindling down to about 300,000, but they were over a million just in 2003. the Yazidis, we heard about them because they were being attacked by ISIS up on a hilltop there, and the world needed to rally. But no, everyone's like, well, what's a Yazidi?
By the way, in retrospect, there seems to be confusion about what actually even happened there, that the so-called rescue, right? As to
what happened with them being surrounded, why they were being chased out, what was happening there.
And even in terms of the result, there seemed to be a lot of theater involved. The number of people who ended up being rescued seemed to be smaller than the original, we got to go in there because they're all about to die. And then the numbers seemed to shift.
Well, I think they look for, I mean, when they're determining U.S. policy, people are so war-weary of Iraq. But the idea of going in and they're going to rescue these people, they wanted to hype this up. It's going to be a humanitarian mission, you know. We need to save them from this imminent catastrophe. And then ISIS changed their tactic. Instead of just massacring and beheading Syrian and Iraqi soldiers, they started killing Western journalists and Western aid workers. Mm-hmm. And that suddenly took, you know,
got everybody's attention.
That and the fact that they keep saying that they've got all these foreign fighters that have volunteered from Canada, from America, from Europe, who will one day return home.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly it becomes that it's now in my backyard. Now we need to be afraid, right?
Yes.
Before then it was like, well, some Yazidis. Well, who the hell are they? I mean, it's, we're not going to get back into Iraq for them.
Yes.
They would have wanted us to. I mean, they wanted to drum up support, but that wasn't going to register. And even in the north, I mean, of all the people that are most misunderstood or little studied is the Yazidis. Like, this is a unique group of people, unique to Iraq and Iran. I mean, there's only elements of them. They have their own distinct language. And everyone else, the Arabs, the Kurds, the Turkmens, regard them as devil worshippers. Mm. And I've been to their temples and I've met their priests and talked to them. And they explain that they don't worship evil. But in their religion, God is good. God will always be good. So there's no need to pay homage to him. Whereas the evil sins, if we don't respect them, will creep into our soul and force us to do bad things. So that's the root of it. But everybody, my translator said, no, they're devil worshippers. And I mean, you can imagine that come nightfall.
They acknowledge the existence of the devil, which makes them devil worshippers.
Well, they come out of the
There's a few evangelicals who get hurt with this story.
Well, they have seven pillars that they you know, take the incense around on each of the seven deadly sins, and they pay respect to them. So, anyway, it was an interesting.
You were there. You weren't embedded, but boy, you were there.
Well, in those early days, even before the Americans came in, I was trying to get a handle on just the complexity of the society, because you had people like Paul Wolfowitz who were pushing for the war, saying that there's only two kinds of Iraqis, the ones who support Saddam and the ones who want him gone. And I was in the country saying, well, there seems to be an awful lot more different Iraqis. Like, there's actually no such thing as an Iraqi. You've got Sunni Arabs, you've got Shiite Arabs, you've got Turkmen, Shiite, Sunni. Well, Kurds are divided by Shia, Sunni.
Yeah.
It's quite a mix, and you've got the Sabia people, the Yazidis, the Marsh Arabs, none of whom can actually claim that this is, the one entity.
Well,
so.
I hate to use the word, but somewhat tribal, right? In other words,
very tribal.
And you point out that, by the way, this is quite a, I think you clarified it better than anybody I've been reading, by the way, this is Scott Taylor, and it's Esprit de Corps.ca. You said that when Baird went for his visit, and if anybody goes there with the Canadian forces such as they are that would be deployed, they're going to be under a Kurdish flag. They won't see an Iraqi flag.
No, if they're landing in Erbil, you'll see, and if you've seen pictures of them behind Baird at the different outposts, etc., it's a green, white, and red stripe with a big sunburst. That's the flag of Kurdistan, and it's flown and has been flown in the north of Iraq since 1991 openly. And
we should mention that more, shouldn't we?
Well, there's certain maps where it is called Kurdistan. If you go to Vienna, you can get an Austrian Airlines flight to Kurdistan, to the capital. It's advertised in their magazines. I mean, but other places, obviously NATO countries, etc., cannot mention Kurdistan because of Turkey and its sensitivity to that issue.
Well, that might explain why Turkey today is not signing off on the big mission.
Well, you can imagine. They have fought over a decade-long brutal counterinsurgency against the Kurdish separatists in the east of Turkey, and they've made conciliatory gestures. They militarily defeated the PKK, the Workers' Party, pushed them, the remnants of them, into northern Iraq, where they still launch cross-border attacks on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So the idea of arming Kurds in the north of Iraq and not thinking it's going to have repercussions in eastern Turkey at some point in the future is naive in the extreme. Yeah. And that's where I don't think Baird quite understands just how sensitive all these little tripwires are. The Kurds that are fighting in Syria against Assad aren't really fighting so much for against Assad as they are for an independent Kurdistan. They want to break that piece of territory away and join their Kurdish brothers in the northern provinces of Iraq and create a greater Kurdistan. So all these things...
This is the bubbling cesspit you're talking about.
It's, and then having been there and studied it, met the people, I mean, it is one of those places where it's so difficult sometimes to realize, like, who do I trust and what is their interest in this? And a lot of times the Americans felt that they, because the Kurds were getting benefits from the U.S. invasion, the Kurds were able to push south and they were able to take over all kinds of former Ba'ath Party houses. The Kurds went into Baghdad, took every government vehicle. I mean, this is a well-known fact. They took every government vehicle, all these Toyotas that Saddam had bought, and drove them across the Iranian border. I mean, they literally took a mass theft of government property and flogged these things. You could get them for like $500, these brand-new Toyota pickup trucks that crossed the border. And they were paying Arab residents in Baghdad a fee to drive them.
Well, thank goodness we're reading Scott Taylor, EspritDeCorps.ca, because, you know, we don't get this a lot. We have things called mainstream papers, but they don't share this much information. You point out there's another little problem. Baird was saying we want an inclusive Iraqi government, but he's talking to parties which are led by two individuals, Mr. Barzani and Mr. Talabani,
who don't
exactly admire each other.
They are clever, though, because in 2005, when they realized that democracy was going to be, the process was being brought to the north for the Kurdistan regional government, they formed an alliance so that they became basically a super party, the PUK and the KDP, the two parties, and then took 90% of all the votes, and then they simply went back to dividing up the power between the two of them, as they always have.
Well, and you mentioned, too, that a lot of those posts that they distribute are basically family members.
It's the nephew or the son.
It sounds like Toronto, for crying out loud.
It's, I mean, Bob Ford, Doug Ford, I mean, yeah, of course. But it's not, nepotism is not new to politics. I mean, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., Hillary, Bill Clinton, I mean, the Kennedys.
You're right.
But in this case, it's
we never
tribal.
Talk about our tribes.
It is tribal, and these guys have made these deals, and they've pooled the power. But right now, and that's sort of what's not really known, is that they've taken over the oil fields in Kirkuk. This was denied to them all the time. It's what prevented them from having the economic stability to become a country by taking the Baba Gurger oil fields and holding on to it, you know, saying that they're doing it in the face of the ISIS threat. It's what they've wanted all along. And this now is what's sending them into the sort of a race to have a referendum while they're holding on to that oil. That oil represents about 40% of Iraq's revenue. The 60% is in the south where the Shiites are. They've got that around Basra. There is no oil in the ISIS-controlled area. So the Sunnis, whether they're moderates or extremists, I mean, they are left out in the cold, which is what's forced them into the support that they've given now for the extremists, the ISIS, to try to find some way to survive in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's got to be resolved, not sending guns and advisors to the Kurdish factions in the north, because that's only going to further divide Iraq.
Yeah, and by the way, you're, of course, an experienced military man. You've been there and seen the whole show. It seems absurd, the idea that we're going to be advising anybody. These guys have been fighting since they're 9 years old, right?
They know all the players. They know who is who within the KDP, within the PUK. They know their Turkmen, which village is a Christian village. They know everything in that area.
And they have command of weaponry. They know how to fight.
They've been getting weapons from the Americans since before 1991. They've got all kinds of weapons, and they can know how to use them. But again, their level of determination isn't quite the same as that of ISIS, who are eager to be martyred. I mean, these guys have shown that. And it also should be pointed out that the fall of the Iraqi army, the collapse, after all those years, the decades of American training, American advisors, and billions and billions of dollars worth of weaponry that they gave them, heavy weaponry, vehicles, everything. And these guys just disappeared. When they took the city of Mosul, those forces disappeared. And if think about it, even if you're petrified, if you're a real cowardly Iraqi soldier, wouldn't you get in the armored vehicle and drive it off to safety? Why would you leave it topped up with gas and ammunition for the guys to follow you? They didn't even make an attempt.
Somewhere in there, there's a wink.
Oh, there's a huge wink. When I was held with my colleague, and we were moving around, this is while the Americans were there, if there was no Americans present, they moved us openly as hostages. through Iraqi police checkpoint. They were completely in collusion. It was Iraqi police that turned us over to Ansar al-Islam in the first place. So we saw that level
important
of cooperation.
Detail.
Even just beneath the Americans while they were there, they couldn't see. It was like a blind man walking on a roof.
Yeah.
And it was all under, you know, and that's the same groups now that would have said, okay, on the so-and-so date of June, leave your outpost and leave the keys in the ignition.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming in.
This is Scott Taylor, EspritDeCorps.ca, and you've led me to my $64,000 question. The Americans, it was debated, should you break up Saddam's army, which they decided, yes, you should, and should you break up his political organization, yes, you should, and then it was all going to be rebuilt. So it's been about 10 years, I guess, roughly, rebuilding, and they say, we can leave in 2011 because they're all set. Well, now America says that they have to use their air power against ISIS. And my question is, how come you didn't give them an air force?
That's a good question. That's a good question. But they got to remember that they'd have to start an air force from scratch in the 1991.
You would hire the former pilots, right?
But go back in 91, that the Air Force defected in that bizarre move. I don't know if you recall, but during the first airstrikes against Iraq, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, all the planes were flown into Iran.
Yes.
It was done. It was a move that was organized. All the Iraqi planes took to the air and landed and sought refuge there. They were parked there. And this is after this long war between Iraq and Iran. So all the pilots are gone. So even in the interim period under the sanctions, there was no air force. They weren't allowed to fly. They had no aircraft. So that whole capability.
But they haven't delivered them either. And
no,
I was looking at Wall Street Journal, and they said, well, Pentagon explanation is, well, they didn't make the payments. And you say, I thought you wanted to protect them. Take a debt, right? I'll pay you next week.
They're pumping oil. Like, why wouldn't they take aircraft? But they would have had to start training the pilots like 5 or 6 years ago. You don't just create a pilot in 3 months.
No, I agree with you. But it doesn't take much more than that to get them going. We even had William Faulkner came up here and learned to fly a plane because he wanted to fight.
And we would never think about sending our troops in without air power.
No, indeed.
Same in Afghanistan, and that's about what's going to happen in Afghanistan.
Which raises a question, a last question here, roughly the territory of a question. As you know, we have the thing called fog of war. We seem to have a fog of propaganda, because if you look at this meeting of the Grand Alliance, there's a number of people who didn't quite sign on. Syria and Iran were not invited. They have quite an interest in the matter. And then you get odd statements like France saying they won't fly without Iraq authorization. They didn't say American authorization. They said Iraqi authorization. And I asked an authority on Iraq earlier today. He wasn't able to make it on the show, but I just asked him a question. I said, did Iraq agree with the United States about overflying Syria? And he said, no. Iraq has not asked the United States to talk about attacking anybody in Syria. They wanted it. So isn't there a danger here that we're not telling people that if they do overfly Syria, you could find yourselves with a totally different issue?
Well, there was a case where the Syrian Air Force came out and attacked ISIS in Iraq, and that was done, was briefly done with Maliki's blessing. But, I mean, this is the condemned Assad.
Oh, he's gone now, isn't he?
Who?
Mr. Maliki.
He is, yeah. But, I mean, at the time, he was still there, and they were struggling, and ISIS was on the rampage. It looked like they were going to take the whole country. And they were asking Assad to bomb in support of what was left of his army. You've got the Iranians in Baghdad alongside Americans trying to advise the Shiite militia. Like, this is the most complicated. Like, who's the bad guy? I mean, Iran is now becoming a good guy.
Well, if I was that Shiite militia, I would go back to headquarters and say, which one of these guys you want me to listen to?
Well, this is it. I mean, we obviously, Baird knows we can't send our guys into the south or Baghdad because we'd be advising Shiite militia that take their orders from Iran. Mm-hmm. And we kick the embassy out, even though we're not at war. Like, it is unbelievable. And that's why I question, why are we in such a rush? We haven't been a player in Iraq. We don't know the footing. We don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about it because I've covered it extensively, but Canadians have not been involved. To send our troops in there, I think I liken it to a prison knife fight in the blackout conditions. I mean, we don't have a single cellmate for
that's
a friend.
For you, not me.
Yeah, it's like, but if you have somebody you know and you might have some alliances, we don't. we're going to get knifed. I mean, this is not something we should be taking lightly. And the idea that we're going to be sending them in there, this decision was made before they could even figure out what they'd be teaching them. Yeah. And they still don't know because they haven't announced it.
Well, it was a Roman general that everybody admired, Fabius, wasn't it, who said, hurry slowly.
Hurry slowly. That's one of the principles of the art of war as well.
Yeah, but our foreign minister...
Never...
But your headline, I think, gets it. Diving headfirst into a bubbling cesspit. The other one, crisis in Iraq, just not that simple. Great articles. Esprit de Corps. It is Esprit de Corps, pardon me, .ca.
Yes.
And it's the ChronicleHerald.ca. Scott Taylor, you're writing important stuff. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
I got a piece coming out in this week's Now magazine, so keep a look for that. It's on the same
page. We will do that. Coming out Thursday, huh?
I guess, yeah. I just filed it 10 minutes ago.
Very timely. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Scott Taylor, and he is, he's got great credentials. They call him the voice of the grunt, which I think means that he is not with the brass, which I can tell you from being in the military, that's the only guy you trust. The brass could get you in trouble. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I think Phil Connors is about to say something.
No, just to write
to
us.
That was an eloquent expression.
No. I was really enjoying that interview. I had that image of the knife fight in the dark in prison, and you don't have any friends.
Indeed. Yes. It remained very quiet.
Don't get involved. Just stay in the corner.
Yes, if you can find it. But by the way, you will find three other guys looking for the same spot. This is, again, the Taylor Report. We are Facebook / The Taylor Report. And what else can we be found? Oh, yes, Taylor-Report.com. We have a couple of pieces there, by the way, about this matter.
And Taylor at CIUT.FM if you want .FM if you want to write us a letter.
Oh yes,
Taylor, which you still can do. I mean, you can still write letters.
People do write, and they will notice that we pay attention. I'm sure people who write to us notice that we tend to pick. We're lazy and we take ideas from people who write to us. So you want to be exercise undue influence? Just write.